Will we ever see another amphibious invasion like that? Not likely ever again, or in our lifetime at least, says our next guest. But lessons still remain fresh, even from 70 years ago on this date, D-Day. Our next guest is Joshua Rovner. Let's welcome him to Kelly & Company. Mr. Rovner, Dr. Rovner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A little background here, because I don't know a lot about you, but just a quick bio and what brings your expertise and why do you... I was reading your article, and it's great, and we can get into that, but why does history make so much sense to you, and particularly D-Day?
Oh, well, the history is hugely important. I'm actually a political scientist, but I can't do my job without knowing a lot about history. Mm-hmm. And history is the data I rely on. History is what I need to help understand the world and to write about politics and to teach politics.
So when you when you hear a guy like Gene who just called,
yep.
And what comes to your mind?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a huge amount of respect, obviously, and I sort of hated the fact that I was pushing him off the air.
Well,
I was loving listening to him.
Right.
Extraordinary life experiences and stuff that it's really a great thing that we're able to record that and keep that for posterity.
I'm here with Bill Rogan, and we were looking through your article, and you use words. First, let's talk about exactly what happened 70 years ago today. And why you believe we're not likely to ever see anything much like that again. But then you use words like chance and uncertainty and contingency and things that, mm-hmm. lessons that still remain fresh even today in military battle.
Yeah, well, one thing that one reason I say that it's probably unlikely that we're going to see something like D-Day in our lifetime is just the scale of what was going on in 1944. You had this extraordinary, truly world war among great powers, all of whom were massive industrial, economic great powers, and the world is just very different today. Right? Back then, you had a lot of great powers competing against each other. Today you have the United States and everyone else. The United States lead in military strength, in its economy is quite staggering. We've never seen anything like it. So it's unlikely that you're going to have that sort of all-out slugfest that goes on and on and on against these massive industrial powers. Now that said, there are reasons to look closely at the D-Day invasions and look for lessons there. And as you said, I am interested in the idea of chance in contingency in battle. The Allies had a great deal of advantages that day. They had almost complete mastery of the air and the sea by that point of the war. They were able to mobilize a huge number of people and naval assets to cross the channel that day. They had a remarkable deception campaign underway to fool Germany about the location of the invasion.
Well, they have those inflatable tanks and inflatable ships and all this stuff. That was fascinating, and we can get into some of these other things, but go ahead.
Sure, and I can talk about that as well. There was an incredible deception campaign called Fortitude, Operation Fortitude, and the whole point was to deceive Germany about the location of the landings. They wanted to tie down German forces in Norway and in a place called Pas-de-Calais, which was up the coast from Normandy, and it largely succeeded. Hitler was firmly convinced that the landings were going to be in Pas-de-Calais up the coast, and refused to believe, even after the invasion, that was anything other than a feint, that we were just trying to deceive him, and that the real invasion was going to come later. So it was a remarkable thing. And yet, despite all of these advantages, there was some chance that factored into the actual equation. What happened was the weather leading up to June 6th was terrible.
Well, it was supposed to happen on June... it was supposed to happen on June 5th originally, wasn't it?
That's right. The night of June 5th was supposed to be the start, but the weather on June 5th was atrocious. Like rain, wind, very little visibility. It was just awful. And the Allies knew they couldn't pull off such a gigantic operation in such terrible weather. Now, General Eisenhower had meteorologists that were telling him that it was actually going to break, that the weather was going to be better on June 6th, and he could confidently prepare for the invasion. But what was going on in Germany is that German commanders didn't think the weather was going to break. They thought it was going to continue being horrendous and that the Allies wouldn't think of trying to do the invasion on that day. So a lot of the German leaders actually went home, right? They were not really ready for it, and they were shocked when the weather cleared and the invasion started. So the point I was trying to make in that short piece was, even when you have a lot of advantages, there's always going to be chance and contingency in warfare. And never assume that things are going to go exactly as you've planned.
If they didn't attack or the beaches invade on the 6th, would they have had to have waited a couple of weeks?
It was not just the weather. It had to do with the lunar cycle, because there needed to be something like it needed to be close to a full moon in either direction, either waxing or waning. So you had to have the tides right, you had to have the moon right, and you had to have clear weather. And the earliest possible next window would have been a couple of weeks down the line, all of which might have given Germany more time to prepare its defenses, which it was still working on. Its defenses were not complete, despite the fact that they were formidable. They were not complete. So the fact that the D-Day was able to go off on the date it was supposed to go off, and that the Germans were caught somewhat unprepared because they weren't expecting clear weather, was a great, great stroke of luck for the Allies.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading some of these facts, how rare is a major amphibious attack, and the answer here, and again, just in some moderate research throughout history, attacks over water were the feature of many wars, they say here. But the Spanish Armada in 1588, and you can failed to invade England, but they had 130 ships at that point and a potential of 55,000 fighters. Compare that with D-Day in the number of vessels and people that were part of today.
Yeah, in D-Day there were well over 5,000 vessels, right? And and
5,000,
and more than that actually, depending on how you count. There were upwards of 1,200 large naval vessels, and then there was this huge number of support ships and troop transports, and all the rest. It's an armada which sort of takes your breath away when you think of the size of it. And there were over 1 million men who were prepared to cross over. In the first day, you had tens of thousands landing, and something on the order of 800 to 900,000 crossed in the course of the operation. So, yeah, it really is astonishing just how big it was.
We're talking with Joshua Rovner, by the way, Dr. Rovner with SMU, national security policy expert, among other credits that are too numerous to get into here. What's the lesson beyond the uncertainty here and beyond the chance? What do we still have in modern warfare that we have learned a lesson from D-Day?
Well, one other lesson that you can talk about is the importance of intelligence, right? And intelligence continues to be incredibly important in war. The Allies used intelligence very, very well, both before, during, and after the D-Day landings. One thing they had done was to crack the German codes, the famous Enigma device. Mm-hmm. The Allies had done quite a good job of not completely cracking it, but getting it down well enough where they were able to monitor a lot of German communications. And what this did was allowed them not only to help deceive German leaders as to the location of the landings, but then to follow up and see whether or not the Germans were still believing the lie. The deception.
Mm-hmm.
So intelligence was hugely important then, as it is now, and it was really important in turning the tide in the Atlantic.
And we forget, you say Atlantic. There was something going on in the Pacific at the same time. Two wars.
There was.
We could have focused all of our attention on Japan, and where would we be today?
It would be a very different world. One of the great questions of the war was why Hitler declared war on the United States on December 11th,
mm-hmm.
right? So Pearl Harbor is on December 7th of 1941, and the United States immediately responds, declares war on Japan, and mobilizes for war in the Pacific. Now, curiously, this wasn't what the Roosevelt administration really wanted. Key military leaders in the Roosevelt administration thought that Europe should be the priority from the start, and yet it was difficult to mobilize the nation for war against Europe after being attacked by Japan.
Sure.
Now that changed on December 11th when Hitler went ahead and declared war against the United States,
yeah.
which made it clear that we were going to be fighting on two fronts. Now, to be clear, most of the U.S. effort early in the war for the first 2 years was in the Pacific. And indeed, the United States doesn't get into Europe until 1943 when it lands
That's
in
right.
Italy.
Yeah.
So So, yeah, it would have been a very, very different outcome.
I was talking to a friend who happens to be Danish, and he said that the Danes, they still celebrate July 4th in recognition of what America has done. Have you heard that?
I hadn't heard that story.
It's pretty cool.
But it's a good one. Yeah.
One more thought before we go away. Just in our question today, when did history start to really make sense to you, generally speaking? We're talking about that 16-year-old to 25-year-old. Just a final thought on the just the weight of this day 70 years ago.
It's incredibly important for any number of reasons, and to stay on your theme of understanding history. I teach undergraduates here at SMU, and in the past I've taught military officers, fairly senior military officers, and I teach the same case. I teach World War II and Normandy for a lot of reasons, because the case is a window into understanding everything from strategy in war to alliance relations to intelligence to the relationship between force and politics. There's just a huge amount that's built into this case study. But what I want, my last thought is, you can't wait until you are sort of in your 30s or 40s or 50s to start thinking about that. We should be teaching undergraduates these things. We should be teaching high school students these things because they're going to be the ones in positions of leadership.
We have to talk to you again. Dr. Rovner, thank you very much for the time this afternoon, though.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
All right, very good. Dr. Joshua Rovner from SMU here on Kelly & Company.